I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The ongoing impeachment trial has the country divided over whether the president should be removed from office. Could an historical understanding of impeachment, which stretches back to medieval England, help us come to terms? Today, a history of high crimes and misdemeanors, and an analysis of how impeachment fits in the present moment. Then, we listen back to one of my favorite interviews with two-time Pulitzer Prize winner David McCullough. He told me Americans' appreciation for history is fading. To help revive it, he's collected speeches on who we are and what we stand for. That collection is titled The American Spirit. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Maybe it's clear from the ongoing impeachment trial of President Trump, but the idea of impeaching an American president has a long history that dates back to medieval England. Frank Bowman thinks it's a good idea for Americans to know some of that history as the Senate debates the fate of an American president for just the third time. The endowed professor of law at the University of Missouri points out that no one has pulled together the history of impeachment combined with an analysis of how it fits the present moment. He's done exactly that, and has made some fascinating conclusions. Now a conversation with the professor about this trying moment in American history. Frank Bowman is the Floyd R. Gibson Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at MU. His new book is High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump, and he joins us this morning from the studios of KBIA over in Columbia. Frank, nice to have you. Good morning.
Delighted to be with you.
You know, you trace impeachment all the way back to the Magna Carta. Was the purpose of impeachment back then the same as it is today?
The fundamental function of impeachment since it was first invented, and technically impeachment didn't arise for roughly a century and a half and more after Magna Carta, about a century. But when it arose, it was a tool invented by the British Parliament primarily to deal with the threat of executive overreach or executive tyranny. Now, of course, in those days, the executive existed in the person of the king, and Parliament was actually a very new institution itself. It was just developing as a representation of other groups in society outside the monarchy, the hereditary aristocracy, the mm-hmm. traditional landowners, the people who controlled money in the cities, others whose interests weren't sometimes opposed to those of the king, and wanted to make sure that he didn't turn the country into an absolute monarchy mm-hmm. of the kind that was more common on the continent. And so they created this mechanism by which Parliament could do something about it. And mm-hmm. of course, the difference in those days was you couldn't impeach the king. The only way you could get rid of the king was really by strapping on your chainmail and starting a revolution. but what Parliament did is said, well, we recognize, and they recognized it a long time ago, that personnel is policy, and one way of preventing an overreaching king from getting too far out of hand is to remove the ministers mm-hmm. who are carrying out his policies. So they invented impeachment, which looked very much procedurally like what we inherited today. That is to say, a charge is filed by the lower house, there the House of Commons, tried in the upper house, there the House of Lords. And over the ensuing four centuries or so, they actually used impeachment for a number of things, a lot of them sort of governmental housekeeping, getting mm-hmm. rid of corrupt officials and so forth. But through with the long continuous thread for four centuries before our revolution and our constitution was that impeachment was resurrected in whenever Parliament felt it needed a tool to deal with a potentially autocratic king.
You know, the founders in this country got so many of their ideas for our Constitution from England. But as you just pointed out, in England, you couldn't impeach the king. So why in this country is the president vulnerable to impeachment?
Of course, the framers thought a bunch about what kind of executive we should have. They considered for a while actually having a king. Alexander Hamilton in particular was rather in favor of that idea. But of course, that's not what we got. We got a president. And we got a president who is essentially the personal embodiment, certainly the head of the entire executive branch. And the framers at least debated about whether they should be able to impeach this president. The threads of the debate were these. One is that some framers thought, well, you know, we have an elected president, not one appointed for life, although they considered that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have elections every 4 years. And some of them said, well, you know, this president person is not going to be very powerful. Come on. The natural locus of power in the Constitution we're setting up is Congress. Hmm. And in any event, if he starts to get out of hand, and of course they would have necessarily thought of him as he, if he starts to get out of hand, there are elections every 4 years. And that will certainly be enough to deal with anybody who's getting really noxious. But other folks in the Constitutional Convention, James Madison, George Mason, lots of them, said, well, you know, it may well be that we get a president who, in fact, does begin to do things that of which we would not approve, who is either personally corrupt or begins to use sort of demagogic techniques to mm-hmm. raise himself into an authoritarian ruler. And if that is the case, we need to have a mechanism for doing something in between elections. And that, for that reason, they created impeachment.
So why is impeachment then, Professor, so rare, given the tumultuous nature of American government?
Well, it's rare for a number of reasons. One of them is I think there is a general presumption that most of the time the way to deal with a president of whom we disapprove is an election. Mm-hmm. That's the primary way to do that in a democracy. And I think nobody disagrees with that notion. I think there's always been a notion that impeachment should be an extraordinary remedy. We should let the people decide wherever possible. But the other reason it's been difficult there's one simple one, and that is the requirement of a two-thirds majority in the Senate to convict, mm-hmm. which simply makes it procedurally extraordinarily hard. In any era, it's going to be very difficult to get two-thirds of the legislative body to kick out the elected executive. And the other reason is that the framers, by adopting a definition of impeachable offenses, treason, bribery, or other crimes or misdemeanors, were signaling a couple of things. One, they were certainly signaling that impeachment was to be an open-ended kind of process, a process that Parliament had been using for centuries to decide on something of a case-by-case basis whether the behavior of any particular officeholder was really sufficiently serious to merit mm-hmm. the removal. But that open-ended, yes, but the standard is one that certainly suggests a degree of high seriousness.
Right.
And I think people have read it that way over the years. So the combination of sort of textual restrictiveness, the procedural difficulty of getting two-thirds,
right.
and a general disposition, so far as possible, to defer to the electorate is really behind that.
You know, in the book, you write that impeachment of President Trump remains unlikely. Now that it appears more possible, not a done deal yet, but that Republicans will agree to call witnesses like John Bolton, do you still feel that impeachment is something of a long shot?
Well, first, of course, a terminological correction. Remember that the word impeachment actually simply means what the House has already done.
Correct. Yes.
Donald Trump has been impeached. And although there was,
conviction is something of a long shot.
Right. Yeah, there was some silly arguments before Christmas that he hadn't really been impeached until the House actually told the Senate that he had. But no, he's been impeached. But the question you're, of course, asking is, is there any likelihood he's going to be convicted? No. Let's be realistic here.
Okay.
For the simple reason that it requires two-thirds of the Senate. And that means that it would require 20 Republican senators, along with every Democrat and the two people who were officially independents, to vote to convict him in order to remove him from office. And you're just not going to get, in the current political environment, 20 Republicans to do that.
But if the Senate was to convict the president and he would be forced from office based on what we know now, I'm wondering, would the reasoning behind that decision be consistent with what the founders intended when they inserted the impeachment provision?
Certainly. I mean, both of the articles returned by the House of Representatives plainly allege offenses of a kind that the framers would have been in every sympathy with. The first article is essentially one charging abuse of power. The president is alleged to have used his authority given him by virtue of his office, not in a way that's consistent with American interests, but to promote his own interests by extorting Ukraine. Abuse of power, despite some remarkably frivolous arguments by the president's lawyers, has been one of the accepted grounds for impeachment back to, well, back to 1376, the very first impeachment of Lord Latimer in 1376 included among the charges that he had notoriously encroached to himself royal power, which meant that he either was exercising power that he didn't have in the name of the king, or he was misusing the power that the king did give him. And episodically, you know, for the next, whatever it's been, seven centuries or so, both in Great Britain and the United States, abuse of power has been impeachable. Indeed, it's the reason we have impeachment, which is which makes the president's arguments the more ridiculous. We have impeachment precisely because, you know, that group of bewigged and stockinged men in Philadelphia in 1787 were deeply concerned in the end that a president might get above himself and abuse the powers that the Constitution would give him. That's why we have this remedy. To suggest otherwise is just not only constitutional nonsense, as I've described it elsewhere, but it's practical nonsense. Of course, abuse of power has to be impeachable. If president, a variety of examples have been given by various folks in the last few days, if a president were to, and Alan Dershowitz, who spoke last night, actually gave this very example in his own book, remarkably suggesting it would be okay. But imagine that a president simply woke up one morning and said, you know, the Russians actually have a better claim to Alaska than we do. Remember, the Russians originally owned Alaska. So Vladimir Putin's asked me to give it back, so I just think I will. That's not a crime. Okay. But it would certainly be an abuse of power and certainly impeachable. Alan Dershowitz, remarkably, said he didn't think that would be impeachable. I mean, that's crazy.
Well, in fact, in the book, you point out that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson wasn't a case of laws being broken, but really over a fundamental disagreement over America's future, right?
Yes. Now, let's be careful here. The first nine of the 11 articles brought against Andrew Johnson did involve a violation of a statute, the Tenure of Office Act, in which Congress had essentially purported to prevent presidents from firing certain executive branch officials who had previously been confirmed by the Senate without Senate permission, and he had fired such a person. But the last two articles don't involve any violation of any statute, criminal or civil. And as you say, particularly the last one, number 11, specifically is about and specifically says that the president had had violated his obligation to uphold the laws and faithfully execute the laws in a variety of ways, most of which had to do with his effort to thwart the Reconstruction efforts of the Congress. It was an allegation that, in fact, he was abusing his power, and it certainly wasn't criminal.
So let's talk about the wording here, this notion, it's the title of your book, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, and what that means exactly. You point out that the phrase is obviously not self-explanatory. So what is a high crime?
Well, already there's the first thing to understand is the way in which we got the entire phrase, treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. Parliament didn't actually have any definition of what an impeachable offense was. Our framers decided they needed one. They liked they liked written constitutions. They liked definitions for stuff. And so they debated what the definition should be through the summer. And by September, they'd narrowed it down to treason and bribery. And George Mason of Virginia thought, oh, no, that we can't have that. That's not nearly broad enough. Mm-hmm. It doesn't include, among other critical things, the kinds of abuses of power that very summer the British Parliament was busy impeaching Warren Hastings for over in London. Mm-hmm. And so George Mason says plainly what our definition isn't sufficient. We need more. He proposed first the word maladministration. When people objected to that, he came back with high crimes and misdemeanors. Everybody looks around the room and says, fine, that's good. We'll have high crimes and misdemeanors. But the key is that high crimes and misdemeanors doesn't mean what you think it means. It doesn't mean what a neutral reader looking at it in the abstract would think it would mean, because it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with crime in the ordinary sense. High crimes and misdemeanors was a term of art that had been used in the British Parliament starting in 1386 to describe the things for which people were impeached. They didn't always use that phrase, but they often did, and they used it with increasing frequency in the ensuing centuries. And it's exactly the phrase they used when they were describing what Warren Hastings had done in his job as the Governor General of Bengal. In other words, this long way of saying that high crimes and misdemeanors is what lawyers would call a term of art. It is a phrase that you can't read you can't pick it apart and say, well, what is a high crime or what is a high misdemeanor? You have to realize that it's a phrase that was simply attached to stuff that we impeach people for.
It's an umbrella term, if you will.
Right. And it has this sort of backward-looking function. By adopting it, our framers did two things. One, they were essentially saying to future generations, we are looking at the kind of process Parliament has used for centuries, whereby it looks at executive abuses on a case-by-case basis and essentially decides, is this particular abuse of authority or misbehavior, is it the kind of thing that presents a real problem for the kingdom? Is it the kind of thing that, as they often said, you know, is a threat to institutional order? And if so, we impeach you. And we'll often call that high crimes and misdemeanors. Hmm. And the other thing, of course, that Mason understood and the rest of the framers understood is that by adopting high crimes and misdemeanors, they were not only getting a kind of process, but they were also getting along with it a body of precedent. The things that Parliament had been impeaching people for four centuries and calling it high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that high crimes and misdemeanors is expressly limited only to things that people, that Parliament had impeached people for, but what Parliament had done gave some guidance, some suggestions to us about the limits of the impeachment authority.
And you point out that in the history of impeachment, that even Parliament removed officials from office for things such as neglect of duty or sheer ineptitude. How so?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they just did.
Mm-hmm.
there were when
so not a
certain
crime
times,
in,
certain
in,
officials.
Not a crime.
Not a crime
in
any sense.
The word, yeah, in any sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not a crime. Well, certainly not a crime in the technical sense of being something that you would charge somebody for in a criminal court, convict them of, committing certain elements and then punish them for in a criminal court. I mean, it was criminal in the broader sense of being wrong, mm-hmm. and contrary to the best interests of the kingdom and now the republic. Now, I think it's pretty clear, and this is certainly true, that the framers wanted to, by adopting high crimes and misdemeanors, they were not suggesting that presidents or anybody else could be impeached for just being kind of bad at their jobs.
Right, right.
Or for disagreeing on ordinary matters of policy with Congress. That's not it. But on the other hand, sort of epic incompetence or total neglect of duty certainly would be impeachable. And we would call it a high crime or misdemeanor because that's the phrase we use. But it certainly is embraced in our Constitution as well.
You know, so of the impeachments that this country has already experienced, that of Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and I guess for all practical matters, Richard Nixon, which one of those does the case against Trump most closely resemble?
Almost certainly that of Richard Nixon. He, of course, resigned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He resigned after articles of impeachment were voted out of the House Judiciary Committee, but before the full House could act. And he resigned basically because a delegation of Republican legislators went down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House and said, Mr. President, you're baked.
Yeah.
You're done.
Mm-hmm.
If this thing goes to – you're going to be impeached and you'd be convicted in the Senate. So I think we can take that as an indication that the kinds of things he did are the kinds of things that Congress would conceive of as being properly impeachable and removable. The first article against Nixon was abuse of power. Second article was obstruction of justice. And the third, critically, was obstruction of the congressional investigation of Nixon's own impeachment, mm-hmm. which is almost exactly analogous to the second article against Mr. Trump, with the exception that none of the sort of obstructive activities that got an article of impeachment voted out of judiciary against Nixon were remotely comparable to what Trump has done.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon did resist producing for a long time, for example, the famous tapes. They were ultimately compelled by a Supreme Court opinion. But he never did what Mr. Trump has done, which is basically issue an order across the entire executive branch to 2 million federal employees. None of you are – you're ordered – the order is that none of you are to comply with any congressional subpoenas in this matter. None of you to produce documents. None of you to testify.
That's now, a big difference.
Of course,
Frank,
we do have evidence.
I'm going to have to wrap here because I'm simply out of time. But I want to thank Frank Bowman again, a professor of law over at MU. His book, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump, a fascinating look back at the history of this practice. Professor Bowman, thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Up next, the great historian David McCullough. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Can't get enough Up to Date? Sign up for my newsletter at kcur.org/Kraske. You'll get my thoughts and exclusive content delivered to your inbox each Monday. It's easy. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe. Tomorrow on the program, he's helped athletes use their stage to protest social injustice. A conversation with Dr. Harry Edwards, who helped organize the Olympic Project for Human Rights back in 1968 and advised Colin Kaepernick. That's Wednesday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when people ask me about a favorite guest on this program, historian David McCullough would very much be at the top of that list. A winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 National Book Awards, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, David McCullough is well known in these parts for his biography of Harry Truman, which reset Truman's place in history. McCullough joined us in May of 2017 to discuss that book and another titled The American Spirit, Who We Are, and What We Stand For. Let's listen. David, welcome back to Up to Date. It's always so good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I have a great fondness for Kansas City and always will because of so much time that I spent there and the wonderful people I got to know and the sense of the spirit of that city, which is quite uplifting and very much helped me to better understand Harry Truman when I was working on that book. I think you have to go where people come from in order to get a sense of how much there is there that derives from their surroundings and their upbringing.
Do you remember what it was that drew you to writing about Harry Truman to begin with, David?
Oh, I remember it vividly. I was having a conference lunch with my editor and publisher, and my editor, Michael Korda, said, asked me if I realized that there was at that time there was no one volume biography of Franklin Roosevelt, and wouldn't that make a wonderful subject? Because I just finished writing a book about Theodore Roosevelt,
mm-hmm.
and I said, "Well, no, it doesn't interest me because I'd like something different from the Roosevelts for my next endeavor." And I said, "If I were going to ever write a book about it." 20th century president, it wouldn't be FDR, it would be Harry Truman.
Hmm.
And they all, around the table, they all, right away, oh, wonderful, Harry Truman. And I have no idea why I had said that. And I said, let me think about this a little bit, because I had never thought of writing a book about Harry Truman. And I just came out of my mouth, and so I came out to Kansas City to the Truman Library and to walk the walk and get to talk to some people. And I found out that Margaret would be very willing to be interviewed at some length.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back all charged up, yes, Harry Truman, little knowing how much I was getting myself into, because I had never written about a 20th century president before, and the volume of material that one has to absorb in order to understand a presidency, particularly a presidency as active and as important as Harry Truman's. So I wound up spending 10 years on that project.
Yeah.
So you can appreciate how much time I spent in Kansas City.
You know, I've always gotten a kick out of the story you tell about when you were researching that book, about the day in 1945 when Harry was suddenly summoned, I think it was from Sam Rayburn's private office on the ground floor of the Capitol, and told to head to the White House quickly and quietly. And this, of course, was the day that FDR had died. What happened next? Because you once relived those moments as best you could.
Well, he was in Rayburn's office, and he went down. He had to go all the way back to the other end of the Capitol to get his hat. He didn't feel he could go to the White House without his hat. And so he took a subterranean, an underground tunnel passageway across the Capitol, which is quite a distance. And I wanted to go down those same stairs. I wanted to go through that same passageway. And then at the end of the passageway, climb the stairs back up on the other side. And I had to arrange it through the Secret Service people there, the Capitol Guards, and in advance. And one of the scholar librarians at the Library of Congress wanted to go with me, so we got permission for him to go, too. And we had, I think, three or four guards and the two of us, and we started off down the stairs and then down the hall, and we were moving fast because he would have been moving fast, and our shoes were making a lot of noise. And there was a rest area room halfway across, and the Capitol Police would go in there for coffee or to take a break. And they heard this rush of feet coming down the hallway, and they came, several of them came out of the door looking very concerned. Yeah. And one of the Capitol policemen was running up ahead, and he said, "Don't worry, we got it under control." And so we kept right on and got to the stairway, and I was really out of breath at this point, and I realized what good shape Harry Truman must have been in, because he went right up those stairs, and I had to pause and catch my breath a little bit. And I also tried to imagine, as best I could, what would have been going through his mind when he's doing that. And, of course, he was all alone. He didn't have an escort of Capitol Police running with him.
Did he know for certain
He was an amazing man. And the more I think about him, the more I reflect about him, the more greater my admiration for him.
Did he know for certain at that moment, David, that he was about to become president?
No, he had no specific information, but he must have known. Yeah. Because the president had never called on him to be in on any big decision or to be part of any inside important conference or whatever at the White House. He had been left out in the cold the whole time he'd been vice president. When I was a high school student, it was during the 48 election, I was very interested in politics. I was 15 in 1948, and I tried to stay awake to find out who won that election, Truman or Dewey. And I'd grown up in a very Republican family. And the next morning, but I couldn't stay awake. I was too tired and couldn't stay awake. The decision didn't come in until about 2 o'clock. The next morning, my father was in shaving, and I went in and said, Dad, who won? And he said, Truman, like it was the end of the world. And about 25 years later, just before I got involved in the book, I was back home in Pittsburgh and chatting with my father after dinner, and he was going on and on about how the world was going to hell and the country was going to hell. And then he said, paused, and he said, too bad old Harry isn't still in the White House. And I thought, isn't that a 180-degree change of attitude? But in fact, it's how the country felt, too, not just him. And when my book came out, there was great interest in Truman to find out, wait a minute, maybe we misjudged this man, or maybe there's more to it than we've appreciated. And I'm glad, very proud to say that that book is still very much in print, still being read, and I'm very proud of it.
I was going to say, if even today, David, if you're surprised by the critical and popular acclaim that the Truman book received, because at the time, you know, he was, when he left office, he was hardly one of our most popular presidents. In fact, he was roundly unpopular.
He was roundly unpopular because he'd made roundly unpopular decisions. And I think one of the more noble moments of his very eventful presidency was when he decided that he was going to desegregate the armed services, really desegregate the federal government. He was warned by several people, if you do this, you're going to lose the election. And he said, if I lose the election because of this, I will have lost the election for a good cause. Mm. And it was the same when he fired General MacArthur. He knew that it would be the most unpopular decision of his presidency, but he knew it was the right thing to do, and he did it. And now, of course, everybody realizes it was the right thing to do, and it was good that he did it.
You know, you can't imagine.
You have to have somebody in that job who has the courage of his convictions, somebody who has strength of character. And Harry Truman had that. He wasn't a great public speaker. He wasn't a charismatic leader. But he had strength of character, and he worked hard at the job, and he never forgot who he was. He said, I tried never to forget who I am, where I came from, and where I will go back to.
And yet, you can't imagine a Harry Truman-like American becoming president in this day and age, the lack of a college education, all of that.
Well, in lack of the sort of the television aura, the glamour or the panache or whatever you want to call it, of being a celebrity on television. And that, I think, was hugely to our country's advantage at the time. My book, The American Spirit, is composed of 15 different speeches I've given over the last 25 years. And Harry Truman figures in one or another, quite often through the book, because I keep turning to him as an example that we can learn from. Mm-hmm. And one of the primary and most important aspects of Truman's background and nature is that he was a lifelong student of history.
Yes.
As you say, he never went to college. He never had a formal or fancy education, but he never stopped reading, and particularly history. And I love what he said. The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. And so you better know your history so you know what the world is like.
And yet, and again, I'm visiting with historian David McCullough, you know, and yet, David, history and the liberal arts aren't held in high esteem these days, particularly in state houses like the ones in Missouri and Kansas, where lawmakers fund, you know, K-12 education and higher education taking big hits in Kansas and Missouri. So you wonder about that.
Well, you wonder. It's a very serious problem, and I have been on the campaign trail, if you will, for about 10 years crusading as best I can about this. Something close to 80% of the colleges and universities in the country today no longer require history in order to graduate. In other words, you can go through 4 years of college and take no history and graduate. That's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was in one of the most disturbing, to me it was a shocking, experiences or moments in my traveling life at colleges and universities. It took place in Missouri. I was lecturing at one of your very best colleges, and this very nice, attractive young sophomore came up and thanked me for coming to the campus. And then she said, because until I heard your talk today, I never realized that the original 13 colonies were all on the East Coast. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what are we doing so wrong? How can this bright, important young American not know that? And not as if, not, it's not just lack of knowledge of history, but lack of knowledge of geography.
Mm-hmm.
And we make such a fuss about how we're living in the information age. And I try to stress to students, information is important, it's useful, it can be critical, and knowing it at the right time and being accurate, but it isn't learning. If information were learning, if you memorized the World Almanac, you'd have an education. if you memorized the World Almanac, you wouldn't have an education. You'd be weird. Learning has to do with the arts, with music, with art, with literature, poetry, drama. Learning has to do with ideas. And as I like to remind students, and I hope I'm still accurate about this, so far, no computer has ever had an idea.
Yeah.
One of my favorite moments in the diaries of John Adams, and it happens fairly often, where his only entry for the day is at home thinking.
Hmm.
Imagine if somebody in political life, public life today, were to absolutely stay at home thinking all day.
Yeah.
How brave, how important, how interesting that would be, and maybe how productive and valuable.
You know, in one of your speeches in your new book, The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For, you spoke to a joint session of Congress in 1989, and you spoke about how much history in this country has yet to be written, which was an idea that struck me as so interesting. In a world full of books, I just hadn't thought about it that way. What are we missing?
Well, we're missing the parts played of significance by innumerable people who have never had a turn in the limelight. In other words, history has not bothered to take a look at what they've done or what they did or why they were important or why they were dangerous or why they were brilliant. And I think that this is particularly true of a number of people who served in our Congress over the years and who deserve more attention than they have ever gotten. And who are interesting human beings. History is human, and it's by getting to know the people of the past, men, women, people of all backgrounds and people of different races and different aspirations and abilities, that you come to understand that those other times were just as interesting, and the people who lived then are just, or maybe even more interesting than in our own time. I've gotten to know people who lived 100 years ago or 200 years ago in my work, through my reading, my research. I've gotten to know them better than I've known many people in real life. Because for one thing, in doing research, you get to read other people's mail, which you don't do in real life. And when you read the letters of Harry Truman or Bess Truman or Abigail Adams and John Adams, then you're really getting inside their world and inside their worries and their dreams and their humor and their frustrations and their pride and all of that, the human side.
Yeah. You know, in our country today, you know, we tend to deride Congress for one failing after another. You remind us in your speeches in this book that there's much to applaud as well.
Well, indeed there is. The GI Bill, let's say, or the national highway system, interstate highway system, just two examples. And the brave people, one of my favorite of all is Margaret Chase Smith, who I mentioned in that speech that I delivered before Congress in 1989. Margaret Chase Smith, who was then a senator and, of course, a woman, which was unusual, not exceptional, but very unusual, who stood up with great backbone and eloquence to denounce what the kind of attitude and things that were being said by Joe McCarthy, mm-hmm. then reigning high and mighty over the Senate.
She was one of the first to do so.
Absolutely. And she said, I speak as a Republican. I speak as a woman. I speak as a United States senator. I speak as an American. I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear. Now imagine what it took to say that right to him at the on the scene. Truman later told her it was one of the bravest things he'd ever witnessed in his whole time in public office.
I wonder if you can take us back to a date that was important for you, David, just a few years back, November 22nd, 2013. That was the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And you spoke that day on a cold, wet, windy day in Dealey Plaza where he was shot down in Dallas. Your speech is in the book. And I was wondering, what was it like to be there on that day of all days?
Well, thank you for asking this. It was very, very difficult for me. It was the most difficult public appearance I've ever taken part in, because I was one of those young Americans in my 20s when Kennedy was elected, who, when he called on us to do something for our country, took him at his word. I was working in publishing in New York, and I quit my job in order to go and be part of the New Frontier, as it was called then. And it wasn't easy for me. I knew no one in the Kennedy campaign. I knew no one in government. But I'd been working for 6 years by then, and I felt that I, with the education I'd received and the working experience I'd had, I could do something in the government that would be of help. Well, I wound up working for the U.S. Information Agency, and it was one of the most difficult and testing times of my whole life, but I learned an immense amount, and I came to value the not just the experience, but the sense of accomplishment, satisfaction of doing something for my country. And of course, Kennedy's death at that time was just a body blow, if you will, to all of us who were in the Kennedy time, but to the whole country. And then to go to the place where he was killed in that dreadful day, cold, as you said, and raining, and there were 5,000 people standing there in the rain. And they'd been there for 4 hours, and they had come from all over the country. It was one of the most moving spectacles I've ever seen. And I tried to do justice mainly to the words that Kennedy left us with. So I quoted a great deal of what were some of the most inspirational speeches ever given in our country.
You know, I read those in the book, and what struck me about those words, David, was something you don't hear much anymore. You know, here you had a president of the United States not offering to do things for the people, but asking them to step forward for the country. And he was actually challenging them in so many of those passages. That was an amazing thing for me to take in.
Well, I'd like to read just a little bit from what he said. And it could be said with the impact and just the inspiring spirit today. I look forward to an America which will reward achievement in the arts as we reward achievement in business or statecraft. I look forward to an America which commands respect throughout the world, not only for its strength, but for its civilization. This country cannot afford to be materially rich and spiritually poor. Art is the great unifying and humanizing experience. The life of the arts, far from being an interruption, a distraction in the life of a nation, is very close to the center of a nation's purpose. And it is a test of the quality of a nation's civilization. I am certain that after the dust of centuries has passed over our cities, we too will be remembered not for our victories or defeats in battle or in politics, but for our contributions to the human spirit. Hmm. How about that?
How about that? Yeah, absolutely.
How about that? Mm-hmm. Imagine if we had a president who stood up and said something like that today. How jubilant we would feel in spirit. How restored we would feel in spirit. And we cannot just dismiss this because it was said 50 years ago. No. Mm-hmm. It's as important today as it was then. That's why history is so important. And he, by the way, of course, as you know, was a great student of history and was the writer of a very fine book of history, Profiles in Courage.
Profiles in Courage, absolutely, yeah. Hmm. You know, I'm wondering, before you leave here today, you know, looking back on a career so well spent and so well invested in the history of this country, you know, is there a moment in our history that you wish you could have witnessed yourself? Because as a writer of this stuff, I can only imagine that you would have wished to have gone back to a moment or two at some point.
Yes, there are. There are. I think it's a very hard question to answer because I can think of 50 places, times, moments, when, or people that I would love to have been witness to. But I think that I might have most want to have been present for when the Continental Congress met for the first time in Philadelphia in what's still called Carpenter's Hall, which is just down the street from Independence Hall, mm-hmm. Where the Declaration of Independence was passed. And the thing about Carpenter's Hall is it's an exquisite Georgian building, the original building, but it's not very big. It's small by contrast to most edifices that we treasure as historic sites. And to have been there when those people from the different states first gathered, and when they didn't know what they were getting into, they really didn't know what was afoot. They had some ideas. And the other thing I love about that place is upstairs was the first library that people could actually come and take books at. It wasn't quite yet public. There you have the birth of a government of the people and the birth of our public library system, the library having been established there by Benjamin Franklin. But the idea of those many, in several instances, like John Adams and Franklin, brilliant Americans convening for the first time, it's as if you're looking, or you're part of the acorn that's going to become the great oak. Hmm. And I would have loved, give almost anything to have been a witness to that.
That's a great analogy. David McCullough, author of The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. Always a pleasure to have you here, David. Thanks so much for taking some time with us again.
Well, it's always a privilege to be included. Thank you very much.
You bet. That was my conversation from May 2017 with Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient, historian David McCullough. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the son of Chiefs Hall of Famer, Derek Thomas. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Thank you.